people go, scuttling a ship, you can't do that. You can't put it on the bottom. Why not?
Calls for sinking the rat-infested pirate vessel anchored near Dutch Harbor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 4th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a rare sighting in the night sky in Juneau.
I don't know how you could miss it if you were facing that direction that time of night. It was just an amazing event.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfort. Details at Condor.com.
An employee of the EAC Native Corporation subsidiary, EAC Tech, was arrested today for his alleged role in a major $20 million bribery and kickback scheme. Harold Babb is director of contracts for EAC Tech, or EAC Technology LLC, a Virginia-based subsidiary of the EAC Native Corporation of Cordova. APRN's Libby Casey has more from Washington.
The top prosecutor for Washington, D.C., U.S. Attorney Ronald Machen, called the case one of the most brazen federal procurement scandals in our nation's history. Harold Babb is accused of conspiring with three other men, two of whom worked for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Prosecutors say Army Corps employees Kerry Kahn and Michael Alexander funneled more than $45 million in payments to a company prosecutors did not name and only called Company A in the indictment. The Corps employees planned to steer hundreds of millions more to the business through a federal contract they oversaw. They padded invoices by $20 million, which went to them, Khan's son Lee, and the EAC Tech employee Harold Babb. Prosecutors say Company A submitted fraudulent and inflated invoices to EAC Tech, and the work was certified as completed. The four allegedly used the illegal money to buy more than a dozen properties, sports cars, airline tickets, and luxury items like expensive watches. U.S. Attorney Ronald Machen called the scheme staggering in scope and said, "I think this surprised us all." Tuesday's arrests came after a major investigation by the FBI, the IRS, and others, including the Inspector General's Office for the Small Business Administration, which administers Alaska Native Corporation contracts. The SBA's Inspector General, Peggy Gustafson, commented on the case.
The arrests today and effective dismantlement of the group responsible for perpetuating this fraud against the American taxpayer is a direct result of the perseverance, hard work, and dedication of our OIG criminal investigators and their partners to rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse.
The four men pleaded guilty in federal court in D.C. Tuesday afternoon and were remanded. They wore street clothes but had their feet shackled. U.S. Magistrate Judge Deborah Robinson will hold a hearing Thursday to decide if they should be detained pending trial. Prosecutors argued they're a flight risk and said the cons threatened a potential government witness. If convicted, the four face sentences up to 25 to 40 years in jail. Officials say the case is in the jurisdiction of D.C. because the Army Corps of Engineers is based there. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
After serving eight governors, the director of Alaska's Washington, D.C. office is resigning. John Katz plans to leave the post at the end of the year. He's worked for Alaskan governors of all political stripes over three decades, providing a constant in the Washington office. In a letter to Governor Sean Parnell, Katz cited wanting to spend more time with his family and said professionally he's become increasingly discouraged by political polarization and what he called the deterioration of the public policy process at the federal level. Katz says it's the worst he's ever seen it. He called his biggest satisfaction working with dedicated and talented Alaskans, and his biggest disappointment the failure to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Katz was the state's Commissioner of Natural Resources in the early 80s, and before that was special counsel to Governor Jay Hammond in 1979 on the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Alaska senators heaped praise on Katz today. Senator Mark Begich said in a written statement that he's appreciated Katz's wise counsel and will miss his calm demeanor and encyclopedic knowledge of Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski said he's lived the bipartisan life so many Alaskans and Americans do. Senator Lisa Murkowski has hired a new fisheries aide. Murkowski's office says Stephanie Moreland will start next month. Moreland will replace Arnie Fugelvog, who pleaded guilty this summer to one count of violating the Lacey Act for falsely reporting where he caught sablefish that were intended for interstate commerce. Fugelvog's sentencing is set for November. Murkowski's office says Moreland's prior work experience includes serving with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, where she most recently was federal fisheries coordinator, extended jurisdiction program manager, and economist. She also worked for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Moreland's portfolio in Murkowski's office will include fisheries and Arctic issues. Federal workers here in Alaska and nationwide began their first workday of the new fiscal year yesterday, and it looks like they'll have another challenging year with budget battles in Washington, D.C., and hiring freezes for some of those who work in the biggest federal agency, the Defense Department. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Fiscal year 2012 is already looking a lot like fiscal 2011, with Congress failing to pass a budget last week and instead pushing through a continuing resolution that will keep the government funded for the next 7 weeks or so. It's impossible to know whether federal workers will again face furloughs and other threats to their jobs and benefits as they did last year, when political stalemate over how much and how quickly to cut the federal budget nearly brought the government to a shutdown at least twice. But one thing is certain, a hiring freeze imposed in August by the Air Force will continue on for at least another month. That means any retirements among the 460 or so civil service workers at Eielson Air Force Base won't be filled until mid-November, unless those positions are declared mission essential. The Army imposed a hiring freeze earlier this year that has since been rescinded, and Linda Douglas, a Fort Wainwright spokeswoman, says post officials haven't heard yet from higher headquarters about whether another freeze is in the offing.
There's still no guidance from headquarters, so we're just, you know, looking at options, but won't have a decision until we find out exactly what headquarters requires of us.
In the meanwhile, Douglas says post officials are carefully scrutinizing every vacancy to determine whether it should be filled or left vacant, at least until Army officials can get a better sense of what the service's budget will look like for the rest of the fiscal year. Fort Wainwright's workforce includes about 1,370 Department of the Army civilian employees, and the post oversees Fort Greeley's 250 or so civil service workers. Those numbers don't include contractors and other civilian workers. The federal government employs more than 16,000 people in Alaska, making it the state's third largest employer. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage teacher talks about his Nobel-winning student.
I'm thrilled to be a bit player in it, and Bartlett and the Anchorage School District should be real proud of him.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
The stateless drift netting vessel Bangoon Percasa is under siege in the port of Dutch Harbor. Local officials and Alaska Senator Mark Begich are calling for the Coast Guard to scuttle the boat, even as rat elimination efforts get underway. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
The 140-foot Percasa was intercepted by the Coast Guard in mid-September, 2,600 miles southwest of Kodiak, and was escorted into Dutch Harbor by the Coast Guard cutter Monroe. The boat's arrival has produced considerable anxiety among locals who fear that rats from the ship will make it to shore. A 2007 state law prohibits vessels from entering state waters with rodents on board, but the Alaska Department of Fish and Game granted the Percasa an exemption yesterday. In order to allow state troopers to evacuate the crew from the vessel, the Percasa was permitted to enter Broad Bay, just outside Dutch Harbor. Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Tom Shoemaker, who helped author the exemption, says federal, state, local, and tribal officials all agreed on the plan before the ship was allowed to enter state waters. The Percasa was at least a mile offshore at all times, a distance which fish and wildlife biologist Steve Ebert says is further than most rats can swim.
They swim away from the vessel, and then they'll swim in circles, and then eventually they just bob up and down like a Coke bottle with the nose straight up in the air.
Rat issues aside, local Mayor Shirley Marquardt says she doesn't want the vessel to end up docked within the city of Unalaska.
And we don't have dock space to just handle any derelict vessel that gets dumped on our doorstep. So I just assume, you know, it goes somewhere else. And I honestly, frankly, I don't care where it goes other than our port.
Marquardt called for the Coast Guard to scuttle the ship.
People go, scuttling a ship? You can't do that. You can't put it on the bottom. Why not? If it's clean of contaminants and it goes down in the bottom of the trench.
Senator Begich also asked the Coast Guard to scuttle the ship, although for different reasons.
It will send two messages. One, we're not allowing any rats in Alaska. But the second piece is, if you do illegal fishing in our waters, we're going to sink your ship and be done with it.
The Coast Guard has not yet commented on the possibility of scuttling the Percasa, but federal regulation requires a waiting period before the government can dispose of the vessel. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
A settlement has been reached in a 1997 lawsuit alleging the state was neglecting its duty to provide adequate funds for rural schools in the state. The litigation was brought by Willie Kasile of Akiachak and the Center for Educational Advancement of Alaska's Children, or SEAC. The case drew the attention of the executive and legislative branches of government when a superior court in 1999 ruled in Kasile's favor. In the settlement agreement, which will have a ceremonial signing Thursday in Anchorage, Governor Sean Parnell promises to include support for the construction of five new rural schools at a cost of $146 million and to continue financial support of $38 million per year for the next 3 years. Charles Woolforth, the executive director of SEAC, says the agreement resolves the concerns of a lot of people. Woolforth is a freelance contributor to APTI programs. APTI is APRN's parent organization.
The people who fought this for 14 years and stuck with it and kept lobbying the legislature and kept up the pressure in court and contributed the money from rural school districts, they've gotten what they asked for, which is new schools being built and a mechanism that will fund schools into the indefinite future on a fair and equitable basis with urban Alaska. And that's, to me, a historic milestone, and that's an accomplishment.
The legislature was not part of the settlement. However, the agreement acknowledges a legislative solution that so far has directed more than $1 billion to rural schools. Woolforth points to legislation from Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman in 2010 that addressed a method for automatically providing funds in future years.
And what the settlement does is it acknowledges that that was a necessity to settle this case, and that it gives us the sort of the entryway back into the courthouse if that's ever not respected, which I think it will be. You know, I think the legislature's come a long way.
The five new rural schools agreed to in the settlement are in Emonic, Kaliganik, Nightmute, Queethluck, and Kivalina. The Parnell administration is still weighing whether to apply for a waiver from the No Child Left Behind Act. School officials in Kodiak have mixed feelings about the act, but they're hoping Governor Parnell decides to apply for the waiver. KMXT's Jennifer Canfield has more.
Current reports show that the Kodiak Island Borough School District is meeting or exceeding state test averages. However, a waiver from the Act's regulations, which requires 100% of students to meet the state's self-appointed proficiency standards by 2014, would be a welcome relief. School Board President Norm Wooten said that he couldn't speak on behalf of the board, but his personal opinion is that No Child Left Behind has been both good and bad.
Now, the good thing about No Child Left Behind is that it's forced us as an educational system and as individual school districts across the country to look at every single child. And that's not something that was done before. And each year, that bar has risen. And each year, we have made progress, okay? But we are reaching the point where progress will be very, very difficult to make.
The waivers aren't an opt-out. They will be more of a trade-off, specific exemptions for proof that schools are not only making progress, but have their own better plans for continued success. It'll be up to Governor Parnell and the Alaska Department of Education to decide whether to pursue the waivers. Wooten says that perhaps a different version of No Child Left Behind, one crafted at the state or local level, would be best. He says that meeting the Act standards has been expensive, though worthwhile, but 100% proficiency is unrealistic.
But it's right for our kids, and so we have chosen to go on that journey. And our teachers are working very, very hard to intervene with these kids and to get them up to speed. And for the most part, succeeding. And our kids are doing better. Will all kids ever perform at 100%? I think that's unlikely.
Kodiak Island Borough School District Assistant Superintendent Marilyn Davidson says that No Child Left Behind really brought to light the individual students who were falling through the cracks. She says it forced the schools to address their unique needs. But at this point, the regulations are more about paperwork than reform.
If we had a waiver, there would still be those areas that we'd work to improve. You know, it wouldn't change the reality of the work that we're doing with students. That's what I would say about the waiver piece. It would just allow us to focus on the authentic work instead of the reporting that might occur.
Reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, of which No Child Left Behind is a part of, is 4 years overdue. Davidson says the district has been anticipating changes to the act for a while.
We've wanted to see a change from statistical reporting of scores to actually looking at how much growth students were making. We've wanted that kind of reform. There are other things that, you know, we've talked about with some requirements for teachers, and we thought some reforms there would be good. But it's something that we've waited for a long time, and we don't know what's going to come.
Governor Parnell hasn't said when he'll decide whether to apply for the waiver. In Kodiak, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
Three communities in Alaska have received U.S. Department of Agriculture Community Development grants. Community Facilities Programs Administrator Tammy Trevino announced the recipients of the awards this morning from Washington, D.C.
This infusion of $46.8 million in 32 states in community facilities direct and guaranteed loans and grants constitutes investments that will create economic growth, jobs, and improve the quality of life in 113 rural communities across the nation.
Trevino says the grants are in line with the federal administration's American Jobs Act, which President Obama announced in early September. The aim is to get Americans back to work through direct spending and infrastructure investments, which will not add to the national deficit. Ilisagvik College, Tribal College in Barrow, received a $205,000 grant for cultural and educational facilities upgrades, and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel received a $25,000 grant for medical emergency services equipment. Jim Nordland is the state director for USDA Rural Development in Palmer. Nordland says the Rural Development Program is aimed at providing grants and loans to communities for quality of life and economic vitality purposes.
Basically, our community facility programs can fund anything from sewer and water to community halls, police and fire protection, ports, harbors, roads, basically anything it takes to build a small community or a small rural community.
Nordland says any public entity in rural Alaska, tribes, or nonprofits are eligible to apply for community facility grants and loans as long as it is for a public purpose.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. October is Alaska Energy Awareness Month, a time to focus on what we're doing to meet Alaska's energy needs and reduce consumption in our everyday lives. For more information, go to akenergyefficiency.org. Energy efficiency in Alaska, it's common sense. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
One of today's Nobel Physics Prize winners is a 1985 graduate of Bartlett High School in Anchorage. Brian Schmidt shares the prestigious award Prize with two other U.S.-born scientists. Schmidt now lives in Australia and works for the Australian National University, but he spent his high school years in Anchorage. The man won for finding that the expansion of the universe is speeding up. It has been called one of the truly great discoveries in the history of science. Former Bartlett teacher Peter Tryon remembers having Brian Schmidt in his geometry class. Schmidt was also a skier on the cross-country ski team Tryon coached. He says Schmidt was clearly a motivated student, but didn't particularly stand out from other academically gifted students.
He wasn't the classic computer geek with no world except science and technology. He was broad-based and witnessed by being an enthusiastic member of the ski team, where he was not the top-level skier on the team.
Tryon says he can't take much credit for Schmidt's success, but he says longtime teachers have to believe their students are going out into the world and doing great things. And he says Schmidt's Nobel Prize is wonderful evidence of that.
This is an awesome example, and I'm thrilled to be a bit player in it and to remember him. And Bartlett and the Anchorage School District should be real proud of him.
Schmidt will share the $1.5 million prize with the two other winners this year. He told NPR when he got a call from Sweden about the win, quote, "My knees sort of went weak and I had to walk around and sort my senses out." An unidentified flying object over Juneau Sunday night had one Douglas couple rubbing their eyes in disbelief. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
About 10 o'clock Sunday night, Matt Colbreth and his wife were watching TV when they glanced out their living room windows overlooking Gastineau Channel in time to see
a large greenish-blue fireball come down from the sky and disappear behind Mount Roberts.
Colbreth says the object was too big to be a flare and way bigger than any other shooting star he's ever seen. It was in the air for a few seconds before disappearing, and both he and his wife were surprised that it didn't make any noise.
Definitely coming down to Earth, though. It wasn't something really high in the atmosphere.
Steve Kosis, a volunteer with Juno's Marie Drake Planetarium, says the Colbreths most likely saw a meteor. That's a fiery streak of light that occurs when mineral objects from space hit Earth's atmosphere and disintegrate. Shooting stars are meteors, but Kosis says some look bigger than others.
They're called the bolide, the brighter ones, and will actually leave kind of like a smoky trail that will change its shape from high-altitude winds, just like jet vapor trails. And the really close ones, people will actually hear them. There'll be a sonic boom.
He says it's not unusual to see one, even in Juneau.
The main unusual part is to have a clear night to actually see the meteor, but it's not unusual to see random events.
Most meteors burn up completely when they hit the atmosphere, but if part of one falls to Earth, it's called a meteorite. Kosis says it's possible to triangulate the location of a meteorite if it's seen falling from more than one vantage point. In January 2000, several Juneau residents saw a falling meteorite that was later found in fragments near frozen Tagish Lake in the Yukon Territory.
A local there at Atland was able to go out on the ice and recover it while it was still warm, and he had the foresight to send it to one of the museums. Turned out to be a very rare one, one with organic chemicals in it.
Matt Colbreth says his wife posted about Sunday's celestial event on Facebook, but so far they appear to be the only ones who witnessed it. He's hopeful that with a little publicity, maybe others will step forward.
I hope so. I hope there was at least, you know, a few other people out there that had seen it. I don't know how you could miss it if you were facing that direction that time of night. It was just an amazing event.
For those who aren't lucky enough to see a random shooting star, there are two big meteor showers every year, the Perseids in August and the Leonids in November. If the weather cooperates, you might even be able to see them in Juneau. I'm Casey Kelly.
The Aleutic Museum is moving forward with a project that will help preserve indigenous knowledge of local food resources and integrate that information with modern preservation techniques. April Lactinen Counselor and Danielle Ringer both work at the museum and are involved with the Aleutic Wild Foods Project. Lactinen Counselor says that the program is aimed at young people who might not have access to information about traditional hunting and gathering methods.
Wouldn't it be great to have a project where we would encourage young people to practice the different types of subsistence that occur here on Kodiak? There are a lot of people that don't really consider themselves experts on harvesting or experts on cooking, but really they do have skills that we want to draw on to help encourage young people to get involved. And I think a lot of people who are young and don't have experience in hunting or gathering, they feel intimidated. They don't want to do it because they don't have any access to someone in their family that might know how to do those things or have taught them directly. So that's kind of where the inspiration for the project came about.
The project is funded by a nearly $40,000 grant from the National Park Service Historic Preservation Fund. Ringer says that each month the museum will hold a gathering focused on the discussion and exploration of a new food.
And what we'll do is have interviews with people, and we'll be a video recording all of those every time. So at the very end, we'll have a full movie that will have a little feature on every single food from the year. And we'll also archive these so they'll be available to people in the future. We're also going to put together a recipe booklet from people in the community. And other than our community events every single month, at the very end, we're going to have a huge potluck for everyone in town. So it should be a lot of fun.
The museum's first gathering was focused on deer. Future gatherings will feature silver salmon, duck, octopus, and kelp, just to name a few. And finally tonight, a correction in a story that aired yesterday about the Pebble Mine and the Save Our Salmon initiative. We reported that Trout Unlimited was a party to a case earlier this month in which a Superior Court judge ruled that conservation groups had not provided enough evidence to prove Pebble's exploratory core holes were already polluting the site. Trout Unlimited is not a party to that case, but is party to another case concerning Pebble Mine, which challenges the state's 2005 Bristol Bay Area Plan. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production, Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.